Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have come to admire greatly the intelligence of a man who, despite his relative youth, has shown a great capacity to think through and articulate, the challenges we're facing in this war for the free world against all enemies, foreign and domestic. His name is Benjamin Weingarten. He is, among other things, a senior contributor for The Federalist, a senior fellow for the London Center for Policy Research, and the founder and CEO of Change Up Media, LLC. I keep emphasizing senior because he is relatively young. And so congratulations, Ben Weingarten, and having achieved those estimable positions. We're glad to have you with us as always. I'm so pleased to have a chance to talk with you about some of the things you've been writing about at The Federalist and elsewhere. Welcome back.
Well, Frank, thanks so much for that most kind introduction.
Well, it's heartfelt and deserved. Let me ask you first and foremost, Ben. I think this is an unfolding story, certainly as we speak. The dime has not yet dropped, as best I can tell, but it sounds as though, as part of the cleaning up that the President Trump has set his mind to at long last in the senior echelons of his government, the departure of H.R. McMaster as the national security advisor to the president seems to be underway. There's back and forth about when and if and so on, not least about who would replace him. But you've studied closely his performance. You understand intimately the necessity for the president to have someone who is not just competent and reliable, but loyal to him in that job. Has he had such a man in H.R. McMaster to this point?
I think it's very clear based on the reporting that there were certain fundamental issues on a stylistic as well as a substantive basis where it would appear that there were clear clashes between the president and his national security advisor. And that's critical because let's put in context what a national security advisor does. The national security advisor is the president's right-hand man on all matters of national security and policy. And also, if nothing else, the traffic cop when it comes to all the other various bureaucracies that play in the space. So it's the national security advisor's job to synthesize all the information and direct all of the processes of the other agencies and ultimately filter the options that come from them to the president and present them in a cogent fashion. It's critical that the national security advisor views the world the same way as the president. And on certain issues, it's been reported that they have conflicting opinions. I think most notably, and probably something that you focused on more closely even than some of the other critical issues, is over Iran deal. And much of the reporting has been that General McMaster has supported kind of strengthening Iran deal at the edges or around it, but not jettisoning it completely. And I think that's a major clash that has existed with the president. It's been reported several times that as we've come closer to these decertification dates and the like, that the president has clashed with staff on this issue. So I think that's one where in particular there's a clash. And McMaster has advocated a much more comprehensive plan to counter Iran. But I have to believe that the Iran deal talks certainly have made the relationship strained over time. And as you said, the president needs to be served by those who see the world the same way. So I think it would only make sense that there would be the kind of rumblings that you're hearing right now.
Yeah, two other points. One is, of course, as you know very well, Ben Weingarten, the president campaigned on a platform of defeating radical Islamic terrorism. And it's my understanding that on basically day one on the job, McMaster announced to the National Security Council staff that he didn't favor the use of that term. And it's been a sometime thing that it's appeared in presidential remarks and the national security strategy and so on since. The other is, you know, the president relieved Rex Tillerson of his job earlier this week. And as you say, the traffic cop on the beat, or if you wish, the man who is responsible for ensuring discipline in the rest of the national security team, is ultimately the national security advisor. And so if the president was dissatisfied with Tillerson's performance, I got to believe that he wants a new hand on deck, not the guy who was enabling some of that bad behavior on Iran and, you know, jihad and so on. Let me turn to several other things quickly, Ben, that you've written about recently. One is, what do we make of this character, Adam Schiff? He is, of course, the representative from California who is the ranking member, that is to say, the top Democrat on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. He's been much in evidence in the news media, specifically with respect to this Russian collusion charge involving, allegedly, the Trump administration. Talk about what he's about and what we should make of his performance today.
Well, yes, I recently wrote an article at The Federalist about this, essentially saying that Representative Schiff should sort of put up or shut up when it comes to the Russia collusion narrative that's been peddled now for well over a year regarding President Trump and the Trump campaign and administration and its ties to or non-existent ties with the Russian regime and Vladimir Putin. And of course, the GOP majority in the House Intelligence Committee, where Adam Schiff, a Democrat from California, serves as the ranking member and the opposition, essentially the resistance, if you will, within that Intelligence Committee, the GOP majority concluded after their months of investigating, among other things, collusion, that there was no evidence of such collusion. And this flies in the face of what Adam Schiff has been asserting for months now, dating back to early 2017, December 2017, into this year. Numerous times, Adam Schiff has said there is ample evidence, and essentially you'd have to be blind not to see it. First, it was circumstantial evidence, and then it was beyond circumstantial evidence. He modified himself, and this was last year, that there was all of this overwhelming mountain of data points building. And when you connect all of them, it proves clearly that there's Russia collusion. But Adam Schiff has never presented, in my view, the clear, cogent, compelling case. And for someone who's as politically adept and articulate as he is and an intelligent guy, it's fascinating that he hasn't actually made that case. And in his argument attacking the GOP majority reports, he actually dropped the word collusion altogether. So while he harangued the GOP majority for shutting down an investigation months ahead of time, and there were all these other people to be subpoenaed and questioned and the like, well, Adam Schiff dropped the word collusion, and I think that's something very telling. And in my article, I go through the best effort he tried to make in the Wall Street Journal last year, where he laid out five different points showing collusion, and I suggest that there's smoke and no fire. And as the Republicans suggested, there might be a lack of judgment or ill-conceived conversations or words, but there's no fire where there's that smoke.
Yeah. You know, it's fascinating. Nancy Pelosi, who is the exclusive arbiter of who serves on the Democratic side of the Intelligence Committee, populated it with people who are partisan political hacks, I think it's fair to say. And Adam Schiff is foremost among them. And I think what we've seen in their conduct as a block in that committee has been appalling. And I hope you're right that we're going to see him shut up if he can't put up as well as his colleagues.
Yeah, and just to add to that real quick, Frank, you know, there's been projection on the Democrats in that committee. All the things that they claim of Republicans about politicizing the process, they've done themselves. And let's note that since you mentioned Madam Pelosi, that Schiff is rumored to be one of the potential replacements as Speaker of the House if the Democrats take it back. So you can't separate that behavior from who Schiff is.
Yeah. Well, and we see a similar kind of model in Chuck Schumer on the Senate side, and it will be a very dark day for the Republic, I think, if one or the other of these people. I'm no fan of Nancy Pelosi, needless to say, but Adam Schiff or others like him actually wind up controlling the House of Representatives. The Republic is, I'm afraid, really in peril. We have to leave it at that for the moment. There's so much more to talk with you about. Ben Weingarten, I am really grateful for your time, as well as the great work that you do at Change Up Media, and as well, of course, at the London Center for Policy Research and the Federalist. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you will come back to us again very soon on, among other things, China perceiving the United States as a paper tiger, a term we haven't heard in a long time, but I fear you're right. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with two of the leading experts on the vulnerability of our electric grid, Tom Popick and Michael Mabee. Stay tuned.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a great pleasure to say we are joined by two of the country's preeminent experts on national security matters, especially as they relate to the vulnerability of America's electric grid. I think it's fair to say that most of us take the reliability of the system that supplies us with power as a given, more or less like oxygen. We breathe it in and it's there. Unfortunately, that ain't necessarily so. And I'm so pleased to have with us the chairman, president, director, driving force, I don't know, Führer über alles of a fantastically important organization, the Foundation for Resilient Societies, Thomas Popick, and Michael Mabee, who is the author of the civil defense book, Emergency Preparedness for a Rural or Suburban Community. Gentlemen, we are delighted to have both of you on, and God willing, we're going to have two segments with you. So I'd like to start by setting the stage a little bit for this conversation. You've both studied closely. You understand intimately. You've done incredibly important work laying out for the rest of us. What's wrong with our electric grid? Start by sharing some of that with us.
Certainly, Frank. This is Tom Popick with Foundation for Resilient Societies. What's wrong with our electric grid is it's not secured against attack by foreign enemies. And moreover, it's inadequately regulated. Most of the security for the electric grid is simply voluntary measures. And we cannot, as a nation, rely on voluntary measures for something that our lives depend on every day.
When you say underregulated or voluntary measures, that seems totally incredible. I mean, this is this gigantic infrastructure spanning the country and providing, as you say, sort of life essential services. How could it be, Tom Popick or Michael, if you care to join in, that it is so poorly regulated and as a result, so vulnerable?
Sure, I'd like to take that. Mike, maybe. The grid, and actually a lot of people might not understand exactly what the grid is, but the grid is actually thousands of companies that are involved in the generation, transmission, and distribution of electric power. And of course, this entity, the grid, is what every critical infrastructure in the United States is dependent on. And so, you know, Congress has said if the grid goes down for a long period of time, hundreds of thousands or millions of Americans could die as a result. So, you know, it's a national security issue, the security of the grid. Now, the interesting thing is the grid, all these thousands of companies are self-regulated. So the United States government can't tell the grid to harden itself against attacks. It has to go through this mind-numbingly complex process of self-regulation to get any kind of rules up. And Foundation for Resilient Societies has been instrumental in trying to hold the government accountability to get the government accountable to having some modicum of security rules to hold the grid too. And this has been quite a challenge.
Well, I get that. And I want to develop it a little bit further because of some of the recent to-ing and fro-ing that's been taking place specifically with respect to cyber. But just, Tom, can you explore this with us just a little bit further? There is a process that involves something called the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, and something called the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. NERC, as it's known. What's up with FERC and NERC, and why is it so deficient in terms of an effective regulatory system on behalf of the American people whose survival may depend upon what they do?
Certainly. I'm going to just contrast the regulation of the electric grid to the regulation of food and drugs. So we have a FDA in the United States because people were ingesting tainted food and they would die. So the FDA can then set a regulation which is mandatory. For the electric utility industry, it's a very different process. There's a self-regulatory body called the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. This self-regulatory body has the sole authority to set standards for the reliability of the electric grid. The governance of this organization is about 70% representatives of electric utilities, so it's a fox guarding the hen house kind of thing. There's this nominal overlay that the standards that are developed by NERC, as it's called, have to be approved by an obscure federal agency, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. In practice, FERC, as it's called, takes a very light hand, and they almost all the time just approve the standards that are set by the self-regulatory body, NERC.
In other words, a kind of rubber stamp of this self-interested, self-regulating body. And Tom Popick, I want to echo what Michael maybe has said. The work that the Foundation for Resilient Societies has performed in trying to keep people honest in this process is incredibly tedious, painstaking, and yet vital work, mostly, if not entirely, obscured from public scrutiny. But talk a little bit about what your organization has been doing now for years, maybe by exploring with us this this question of the latest regulations on cyber security of the grid.
Sure. I'm going to succinctly give you an example. In January of 2016, my group, Resilient Societies, proposed a petition for rulemaking for mandatory detection, reporting, and removal of so-called malware. This is when foreign attackers get into the systems of electric utilities and install malicious software. So we said there should be a program to detect this software, to remove it, and to report its detection to the federal government. We put in this petition in January of 2016. Incredibly, the FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, disregarded nearly every aspect of this petition. Well, just yesterday, the Department of Homeland Security came out with an alert. I'm going to read the title of this alert. It's Russian government cyber activity targeting energy and other critical infrastructure sectors. The alert goes on for pages, but a key part of the alert is the insertion of malware into the systems of electric utilities.
Oh, sink me. You know, this is, I'm fond of saying, in the intelligence world, the technical term for this is a clue. We're talking about being people put on notice that we've got a problem here. So what has the FERC's response to that been?
Well, I think that FERC views itself as essentially a partner with electric utilities in this program of mostly voluntary compliance. There's this so-called docket process where these electric utilities can put in comments that say how they really shouldn't be regulated. And on this particular point, I think Mike maybe could really shed some perspective because he's put a lot of work into reading some of these docket comments from the utilities. Mike, what's your perspective?
Yeah, my perspective is, you know, in being involved in this latest one, you know, on the cyber, and we had quite a few people put comments in about the cybersecurity of the grid. And the electric industry's response was that putting these types of cybersecurity safeguards in place is unduly burdensome and unnecessary. And, you know, I'm scratching my head and I'm thinking, okay, so the electric industry is telling Americans that their safety and the safety of their family and you know, their very lives, you know, protecting that is unduly burdensome and unnecessary.
It sounds as though we're inconvenient to them, doesn't it? Gentlemen, we have to pause for just a second. We'll be right back with more with Tom Popick and with Michael Mabee, military veteran of two deployments in Iraq, the author of Civil Defense Book, Emergency Preparedness for a Rural or Suburban Community, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say joined for a second segment by two of the people who I've come to admire most for their work in the space of understanding and helping the rest of us understand the vulnerability of something essential as a practical matter to our survival, not just as individuals, but as a society, as a nation, that is to say, the vulnerability of our electric grid. And let me just ask, before we get back to some of the details on this cyber business, for one or both of you to comment on something that is often mentioned when we have this kind of conversation, and that is, you mustn't say any of this because our enemies will learn about the possibility of destroying this country, perhaps with a single nuclear weapon detonated in space or through physical attacks on 9 of our facilities around the country, certain select few, or through cyber means, malware and the like. Your response to that proposition, gentlemen?
Sure, Frank. What I would say is that horse has long left the barn. All of our enemies are completely aware of and exploiting our cyber vulnerabilities. Our enemies are aware of EMP and what that can do to the electric grid. The only people who really are in the dark about all of this are the American people, are the people who flip the light switch and, you know, expect that the power is going to go on. It's absolutely critical that, you know, Americans know what the Iranians know and what the North Koreans know and what the Russians and the Chinese know about the vulnerabilities of our grid. So us talking about this today, we're not educating anybody as far as enemies. They all already know and are working to exploit these vulnerabilities.
Yeah, and let me just say thank you for your book, the Civil Defense Book, Emergency Preparedness for a Rural or Suburban Community. You can find out more about it, folks, at civildefensebook.com. So let's go back to cyber as an example. Tom Popick, you've just mentioned that yesterday the Department of Homeland Security is announcing the danger that we face from cyber attacks emanating from Russia in this environment. And I'm just trying to figure out how could it possibly be that the regulatory mechanisms you've described here, the self-dealing, self-interested, utilities-dependent North American Electric Reliability Corporation, a sort of trade association, I think it's fair to say, working with this agency that is ostensibly overseeing their work, but mostly rubber stamping them, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, is seemingly indifferent to the very threat that you've just mentioned DHS is warning us of.
Yes, certainly there's enormous defects in this regulatory system. And I agree with Mike, maybe it's the American public that's being kept in the dark. I'll give you a very specific example. There is a nominal reporting standard for cybersecurity incidents, which was developed by this self-regulatory body, NERC, and approved by FERC, for all of 2015 and all of 2016. There was not a single cybersecurity incident reported to the federal government by NERC. And so we find out just within the past week or so that an unnamed utility has been fined $2.7 million for taking the details, a contractor took the details of the configuration of their network as well as passwords, so much other confidential information, and put it on the public internet. This treasure trove of information for an attacker was found by a so-called white hat security researcher who informed the federal government. Then there was some degree of denial of the magnitude of this incident. the federal government is still not disclosing the utility that was so imprudent to allow this to happen.
So wait a minute. Let me just make sure I understand this. You have had, in the face of actual attacks on the cyber infrastructure of the grid, the information that enemies of this country would need to engage in those sorts of attacks, and it was on essentially open platforms that could be readily accessed by them. A so-called white hat guy, a cybersecurity defense person, presumably, found it, raised the alarm about it. This unnamed company has been fined almost $3 million for doing it, and yet there's not enough disclosure to say who it was and what the damage done might be. But more to the point, we're still not getting fixes made to the grid to protect us from these sorts of attacks.
That's correct. One of the more shocking aspects of this incident, the $2.7 million fine and the disclosure of the treasure trove of information needed to attack this large utility system, is that that is not a so-called reportable cybersecurity incident. In other words, under the standards that have been set by NERC and approved by FERC, this federal agency, that does not even rise to the level where it would be reported. Not
so there's no threats to the grid. There's been no attacks on the grid because we don't consider ones that have happened actually reportable incidents worthy of note. So we're getting a completely fraudulent representation of the magnitude of our vulnerability. Would that be fair?
I think fraudulent would be putting it very charitably. Yes.
Michael, maybe as you're looking at this as a man with, time in grade, as they say, in the military, Michael, maybe as you're talking and thinking about this, is it fair to say that this is, the lawyers would use the term, I think, an attractive nuisance? We're inviting attacks by leaving these kinds of known vulnerabilities in place and pretending they don't exist, whistling past the graveyard.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We have, our regulator, FERC, who's supposed to be protecting us, is asleep at the switch right now. And the industry that, doesn't want these burdensome regulations to protect the grid is left making the rules. And meanwhile, Americans everywhere are in danger. This is an existential threat to the United States. And as you mentioned, we have the threat of physical attacks on the grid. We have the threat of cyber attacks. Also, we hadn't talked about yet, but we also have the threat, something known as a geomagnetic disturbance, or everybody's heard of the term solar flare. In 1989, the province of Quebec's grid was taken out by a relatively small solar flare. And we know for a fact that solar flares are constantly shot out in every direction by the sun, and occasionally they strike the Earth, and occasionally a large one can strike the Earth, and our grid is not prepared for an event such as that. A coordinated attack against several transformers, as we saw, one transformer attacked out in Metcalf, California.
2013. These are real world problems, and you've described them, as I understand it, in your book about the grid's vulnerability. And again, I hope people will find it at civildefensebook.com. It's entitled The Civil Defense Book, Emergency Preparedness for a Rural or Suburban Community. Michael Mabee, thank you for your time today. Tom Popick, thank you for yours and for the great work both of you are doing. I would just say, Michael, in closing, if the FERC were only asleep at the switch, it would be one thing. I fear they are being willfully blind and malfeasant when it comes to doing their job, which is to oversee, regulate, and ultimately ensure the reliability and resiliency of the grid upon which we all depend. Gentlemen, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but we will be following this closely. I know you will be too. Come back to us again very soon, if you will. Next up, we're going to be speaking with Charles Limandri, who is a president and chief counsel of the Freedom of Conscience Defense Fund, about what's happening with Islamism in his native San Diego right after this.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined, I'm very pleased to say, for the first time by a man I have heard of by reputation. It precedes him, as they say, but not had the privilege of speaking with. I'm very happy to have with us Charles Lemondry. He is the founding leader of Freedom of Conscious Defense Fund, based out in San Diego, and also named partner in Lemondry & Jonah, LLP. We have caught up with him because of some of his past work, but let me just take a minute to tell you about some of his credentials. He is a lawyer trained by my alma mater, Georgetown University. He has spent a lot of time in other academic institutions, including some prestigious ones in Oxford, England, including the Oxford program of the University of San Diego. He has been recognized for his leadership in his profession by a number of its preeminent organizations, including the 2014 to 2016 list of super lawyers. And he is admitted to the U.S. Supreme Court bar, but we're here to talk with him particularly about some of the work he's been doing in his own hometown of San Diego, and very pleased to welcome him to our microphones for that purpose. Charles Lemondry, thanks you so much for taking the time to join us.
Good to be with you, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure. Let me ask you first and foremost about the work you've been doing with the Freedom of Conscious Defense Fund, specifically in connection with two matters that seem to be really exemplary of what is being done by what I think of as the red-green axis, that is to say, secular hard leftists and their incredibly Islamist allies, specifically with respect to a church directory that the city of San Diego has had up for many years in Coronado, and something called the Anti-Islamic Bullying, you know, Project. If you would walk us through what's going on with both of these.
Sure. As far as the church directory in the city of Coronado, we learned about 3 weeks ago that this anti-religious group, which calls itself the Freedom from Religion Foundation, had sent a letter to the city of Coronado, city council, saying that they needed to remove a sign that had been up for something like 60 years, which is just a directory of various churches located in Coronado. And it's a nice sign. It's in Sprickles Park, which is on the main street as you enter Coronado. And it's kind of a welcoming type sign. So I sent a letter to the mayor saying that the Freedom of Conscience Defense Fund would be happy to represent the city pro bono, because they shouldn't have to remove the sign. It's not devotional. It just lists the various churches and their addresses. And I have not heard back from the city that they want us to help them, unfortunately. And I think that they're going to cave in. And what I had heard was they just didn't want to engage in a big, long, protracted fight. You know, I headed up the charge on the Mount Soledad Cross case in San Diego for 12 years. So it was a long, protracted fight, but it was worth fighting, and we won. And that great memorial cross is still there and will be there.
You won, as I recall, at the Supreme Court level, right?
Yes, it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And basically, the Supreme Court would not let the city remove it until all potential judicial avenues had been exhausted. And before we got up to the Supreme Court, we fashioned a remedy whereby the cross would not have to be removed. So we didn't get that final Supreme Court decision would have liked, but we didn't need it. We accomplished our objective.
Mission, yeah. So talk about this anti-Islamic bullying business. The city of Coronado is going to its knees on this church directory, evidently, peremptorily. What's going on in this matter of, do you have a serious problem with anti-Islamic behavior or bullying, Islamophobia in the area of San Diego?
Not at all, Frank. And that's the problem with this whole initiative. It's a solution, looking for a problem, so to speak. The last statistics that we have available for the last half of 2016 that the school district released was that out of 124,000 students, they only had 7 reported instances of bullying involving religion, but none of them were identified as Muslim bullying. So as far as we know, they probably track national statistics where Jewish students tend to be bullied at 4 times the rate of other students for religious basis. So we're not aware of any Muslim students. Now, some older statistics they gave, I think there was like in a 2-year period, 2 Muslim students claimed they were bullied in the school district in the course of 2 years. So you're talking about 124,000 students over 2 years. Does that justify changing the curriculum and having Muslim holiness? No. And where there is, of course, anti-bullying programs. We don't want even one student bullied one time, but there are programs in place to prevent that. This is a ruse because the Council on American Islamic Relations is trying to implement their agenda, and that includes stocking the library with all kinds of pro-Islamic books that present a very one-sided and distorted view of the religion and political ideology involved. And the city of San Diego has a spending freeze, but yet they spent over $80,000 just on the Muslim books alone. Now they have Muslim prayer rooms. They've got the Muslim holidays. Go ahead.
Yeah, but I just wanted to say, you described this as a solution in search of a problem. It seems to me it's really a demand for an accommodation in search of people who are willing to submit to such demands. And that's, unfortunately, the trademark of this group, CARE, as it's better known, the Council on American Islamic Relations, is that they're constantly, talk about bullying, they're constantly bullying people into making these kinds of concessions, accommodations, preferential treatment even. As an attorney, Charles Lemandry, let me just ask you, what are the implications for the community in which you live if it relents and accedes to these kinds of demands? Do you expect that that will be the end of it, or there will be more, and submission will become that much more of an incentive to embolden these characters to demand yet more?
Well, clearly, they always do. And they CARE has been pretty upfront with the fact that they consider this a pilot program that they want to roll out all over the nation. And the more they get, the more they want. They've got imams coming into the classroom already. Now, they don't allow Catholic priests or Protestant ministers or Jewish rabbis into the classroom to hand out religious literature or propaganda that the imams are doing. But they're going to want increased access. And again, CARE has been pretty clear. Their national leaders have said that although they're not advocating violence and spreading their faith, they do intend to use an educational system to do that. Well, the court's been pretty clear that because students tend to be more vulnerable and impressionable than the rest of us, they don't want outsiders coming into the schools to use the school system as a vehicle for spreading their ideology, and in this case, their religious doctrines. And that's what CARE wants to do.
Yeah. Is there an exemption in that general principle, which seems not unreasonable? I mean, I happen to be in favor of, Christian prayer in schools and having God have a place in them. But is there an exception if you're going to not allow that to happen for Muslim prayer or Islamic practice?
Well, not at all. It's just part of this diversity and multiculturalism idea that apparently anything that's not of a Judeo-Christian origin is good. And any traditional prayers, even of a non-denominational nature, before football games, praying for the safety of players or opening the school day as they always used to do with a non-denominational prayer, schools aren't allowing that. But now they're allowing Muslim prayer rooms, which of course have nothing to do with anti-bullying.
And the trouble is that this really does have the effect of emboldening people who have this Sharia supremacist program at heart. I'm so grateful to you, Charles Lemandry, for bringing your extraordinary legal skills to bear on behalf of all of us, not just in San Diego, but to the extent it is the front lines in what I call the war for the free world here at home. It's really appreciated, as is the work of the Freedom of Conscience Defense Fund. I hope you'll come back to us often with updates and lend your hand to this larger mission nationwide. And I hope the rest of you will come back to us again Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.